Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk, and this is part one of Behind the Screens, a four-part special dedicated to parenting in the digital age. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. Last month, I took the show on the road and was joined by a panel of experts to talk through the realities of parenting in the digital age. What do you need to know? Where can you turn to if a problem arises? And what practical steps can you as a parent take to keep your kids safe in the online world? Today, I'm bringing you part one, which focuses on the parents of children aged between 4 and 12. This conversation took place in the Radisson St. Helens in Dublin in front of a live audience. You'll hear from Dr. Dara McCashin of the DCU Anti-Bullying Centre, Dr. Brendan Kelly, Professor of Psychiatry in Trinity, and Alex Cooney, CEO of CyberSafe Kids, the brilliant organisation that we partnered with for this roadshow. And I started by asking Alex a question that I get almost every week. Is there such a thing as the right time to give a device to a child?
I'd love to say that there was, and it would make it be so easy, right? But and we do get asked this question all the time, I think probably at every parent talk. And actually one of our trainers, Anne, is here in the audience. I'm sure she's had to answer this question too. What we say is the important thing is to make sure that they are ready for all the access that comes with getting a device, but also that you are ready because you need to be right there alongside them. There is, interestingly, increasingly a sense of hold off, not just in Ireland, but in other countries as well, where parents are kind of coming together and saying, you know, I'm not sure I do want to be giving my child a smartphone or a tablet at this age. Let's talk about it, which I think is a really positive thing. So one of the things that we would always say is talk to your children's friends, parents, and see what their concerns are, because actually it's a lot easier to go back to your child and say, do you know what, I don't think you're ready yet, and I know that two of your friends are also not getting devices. So that kind of hold off until they're ready, you're ready, is really important. We can see a shift in our data as well. So last year when we were surveying children, I think it was 82% of 8 to 12-year-olds had their own smartphone. And obviously that increases as they get closer to 12. So it's around 11, 12 where you see a big shift on smartphones in particular. This year that has dropped to 71%. So I would see that kind of hold-off movement that is starting to emerge around the country as playing a part in that drop, and also a drop in access to social media. So yeah, I think it's about really thinking about all that comes with that access and whether you're ready to accompany them on that journey, because that bit is vital.
Yeah, and I suppose it's something that's tricky, because parents can sometimes feel judgment if they do give their child a device, whether that is a games console or a tablet or a phone of their own. But sometimes it can be quite difficult to negotiate with little people who are incredibly smart and persuasive. But Brendan, what do we know from a psychological point of view? Because there's some scary headlines out there around the damage that screens are doing to our kids. What do we know from your field of expertise?
Yeah, so there are some scary headlines out there about this, and you might get the idea that the sky is falling down and this is the end of the world, and your child's entire future happiness and well-being depends on your decision about the phone at the age of 12 or 11 or whatever it might be. You know, there is evidence that a lot of screen time is not good for mental health, but it's not evidence at a catastrophic level. It's quite robust. So to give you an example, if you have a child at the age of 10 or 12 or an early teenager, and they're spending more than 4 hours on a device per day, we know that that increases the risk of, say, significant anxiety or depression by between 50 and 60%. So it doesn't quite double the risk of significant mental health problems, but it does increase it significantly at that rather high level of use at that age, about the 4-hour mark. So it is a significant risk, but it's certainly not the end of the world. And this is a risk that is manageable. And it is also a dose-related risk. By that, I mean the more time spent on the phone, the greater the risk. It goes up like a straight line. But it's not, you know, it's not something to really be terrified to the very core of your soul about, but it is something we need to watch and manage a little bit better, maybe.
And that's where, you know, the fact that you're in this room shows that you're taking a positive step towards it, to be aware and to be engaged and to understand that there are tools and mechanisms and ways of addressing this. Because when I was younger, it was about TV, and it was about sitting too close to the TV, watching TV for too long, all of that. But I suppose it is different when it comes to a device that the child has on their own in the room. What are some of the practical boundaries that a parent who hasn't given a device to a child yet can introduce at an early stage to try and prevent that big spike?
Well, look, the biggest thing that we could all do, and I'm as guilty as anyone of not doing it, is modelling good behaviour. You know, there is this terrifying moment when once you realise your children are turning out like you. Mm-hmm. Now, you might be happy about that. I was absolutely terrified when my kids started behaving like me. So modelling good behaviour is easily the biggest thing that we can do. And also talking to children about it, and talking about phones, and talking to other families as well is incredibly important. These are intrinsically sort of communal technologies about sharing and connecting. So it is a sort of a communal response that we need. But easily the biggest one, Jess, is how I behave as a parent.
And that's pretty scary, right? Because again, yeah, you have to become very aware not only of what you're doing, but how your child is viewing you. Yeah. If you're someone who needs their phone for work, enjoys a bit of social media, maybe that's how you unwind. I do the New York Times crossword every night and I love it, and sometimes it takes me 6 hours and I don't want to talk about that. But like, there are valid reasons why we as adults are on our phones. So how do you lead a good example whilst also being a bit of a hypocrite?
Okay, well, okay, how to be a hypocrite and also give a good example.
Yeah, Jess, that's all I want in life.
Well, I'm glad you have me here, because this is my specialty.
Stunning.
As it turns out. Yeah, look, there are ground rules, like no phones in bedrooms is a very big rule. So that is having an alarm clock, digging it out again, and really sticking with that as best as possible. Not using the phone first thing in the morning is also a very, very positive, very powerful thing to do. And also having a crisp differentiation between a face-to-face interaction and using your phone. So, you know, literally putting the phone down, turning it upside down and saying, okay, now, what were you saying? Very, very clearly, very, you know, with behaviours, physical behaviours are incredibly powerful. So this means putting the phone in another room. Like, the chances of me using my phone, if it is here, are quite high. If I have to stand up and walk over to that little table there, it hugely reduces the chances of me using my phone. So very simple things like timing, distance, but particularly bedrooms. A lot of the negative psychological effects of screens are mediated through sleep. Young people and adults sleeping less and having poorer quality sleep owing to the amount of time spent on phones. And the research is really strong on this point, that disruptions to sleep directly and indirectly are one of the main mechanisms of harm from phones.
And Dara, this is something that we're seeing. You know, the devices and the platforms are designed, they're like casinos for kids, right? They're designed to keep you engaged. They're designed to get you to do one more swipe to see another video. Are we seeing the implications of those platforms, even though kids shouldn't be on them until they're 13? We know that that's not always adhered to. Are we seeing the implications of that in terms of how kids are interacting and forming their own friendships and identity at that primary school level?
Absolutely. And I think the kind of the dark arts of engagement with app design, I think we've all experienced it in some shape or form. Netflix, next episode loading, will we go to bed? Let's click. Let's watch one more. That's a very specific design choice, because it knows it has an immediate behavioral outcome. The interesting studies, and it's easier to join an app than it is to leave an app. And when you divide that out by age, you can see different apps are making it trickier for parents and children to opt out. Knowing that is that's complex information actually when you map it out. But knowing that is itself a resource for parents to say, okay, this app is that bit riskier in terms of what it's actually doing, because when you're on an app longer, you will become socialized into various norms. Which can spill into offline behaviours as well. So gaming is an interesting example there as well, which is increasingly popular. So often we think of one technology or one social media company, but actually there's some very different beasts out there. So getting to grips with what we're talking about, when and where, is the hard part. But in terms of those early formative experiences, they are coexisting with a whole range of apps. And a whole range of kind of online spaces, a lot of which are incredibly positive, interpersonal, building of hobbies and skills. Often we don't talk too much about that, but it's important just to remind ourselves of that, to then be able to spot the less good stuff.
Yeah, and I want to jump in here for a quick second and talk about something practical, because again, in the questions that we asked you beforehand, we asked if you have parental controls in place, and the majority of the people who responded to the survey said they did not. And this is something that is so simple. So if you haven't given a child a device yet, you can do this. And if you have, you can still retroactively go back and do this. So whether it is an Android device or an Apple device, an iOS device, you can put parental controls in place. So on iPhone, it is very simple to do. You can go into your settings and into family sharing. You can add the child's device. That will allow you to control screen time, apps being downloaded, screen time for apps. So you can turn off access to a certain app after a certain period of time. You can require approval for downloads of or purchases within apps. They're teeny tiny little things, but it does give you an element of control. And then on Android, there's Google Family Link, which is a very similar idea. And again, gives you a good overview of what your child is doing. It doesn't mean you can read all of their DMs and see exactly what you're doing, but you can get an idea of where they're spending their time. And I think, Alex, that is, it's an instant win for parents to have, even just at that level, an eyes-on approach to where their kids' digital lives actually exist.
Yeah, so it's around that kind of preparation and thinking. So like if you're thinking about giving your child a device, say for Christmas or for their birthday, and I know that there is huge pressure from kids to be getting this stuff, it's about just spending that bit of time and looking at, okay, how should I set this up? Ideally, even before it's in their hands, that you've had a look, you've maybe even paired it. Like so in my experience, I had done the family pairing before I gave them the device. So it was kind of all set up and ready to go. And I have to use Family Link for one and Family Sharing for the other. So I'm kind of having to, but they're the same idea as Jess said. And it just gives you that bit more engagement. You can also track location, and they can track you, as it turns out. My daughter seems to track me more than I track her. But anyway, that's another thing. But it does give you an overview. Some parental controls are better than others. So something like Snapchat, I don't think it's that useful. You have this issue with disappearing messages. I would argue Snapchat's probably one for slightly older kids, especially because of the design of it and the interaction potentially with people you don't know. But there's been this really early adoption of it. So we've seen really young kids engaging with something like Snapchat. So I think it's app by app, device by device, considering what tools and controls are available to you and putting them in place. You can't over-rely on them. It doesn't remove your parental kind of oversight and engagement, doesn't replace conversations, but they are a useful tool in your toolbox as a parent. And actually, I know a lot of parents feel kind of overwhelmed with having to set these things up, and if they don't feel that techie, then it can seem a bit too much. But actually, there's great tutorials. You can just sit down and say, how do I enable the family controls on my child's device? And this is where Google and YouTube are so useful, because you can get these tutorials and go through it step by step. So not you don't need to be overwhelmed. They're generally quite straightforward to set up.
And it's something that takes 10 minutes to do. once you have it done, it's in place. And as you said correctly, it doesn't negate the need for parenting after that point, but it gives you a conversation starter with your kids, because you can see what apps they've downloaded recently and you can say, oh, come here to me, what does this one do? And show interest and, I suppose, curiosity rather than being, you can't have this. I think that conversation seems to be really, really important when parenting through this period. Brendan, what do you do and how do you balance the trickier instances of trying to engage your child in these types of conversation? Why do you have that app, or who are you chatting to? How do you go about doing that so that you're not the tiger parent, but you are getting the information?
Yeah, so it's all about approaching it obliquely. So putting in the parental controls is this really good opportunity to do that. Mm-hmm. Because some parents say to me, oh, the kids will get around this, or their friend will have a device that's not as controlled. And that's all true. It's not a 100% solution, but it does produce the engagement. It forces the parent to become familiar with the apps, which is very important as well, to know what they do. And it does start the conversation and shows the child that you're still there. You haven't just literally sent them walking down the city centre on their own, that you're still there. You're kind of keeping an eye. You're kind of not, you know, and it helps with attachment in that way as well, that you're not just letting them off. Obviously, it needs to be an ongoing conversation. Mm. And it's about sitting there and being available when the child has a question, because that's a real opportunity. If they can't do something, or if they're stuck on something and they ask you, that's one of the huge opportunities to kind of slip something else in or to be engaged. But it has to be from the outset,
yeah,
as opposed to arriving in a punitive fashion, but rather an ongoing dialogue that waxes and wanes a little bit.
Mm.
You know, they need to be given a lot of play on this, so they're ready to come back to you when they need to.
And I think that's the fear that I'm sure a lot of people in this room have, is if and when my child comes to me with a problem, am I equipped to understand what they're talking about? If it's on a particular platform, if it's in, whether it's on a gaming platform, whether it's on a social media platform, whether it's something someone sends to them.
Yeah.
Again, I don't have kids, but I have nieces and nephews that I'm very close to. And if they came to me with something, my instinct would be find where the internet had plugged in and unplugged it, so they'll never have access to it again.
Yeah, no,
how do you not lose the head?
That is a very understandable reaction. But the much better reaction is an entirely honest one, which is, I don't actually know the answer to what you're asking me. So can we sit down for a minute and look at your phone and see what the problem is or what the issue is? You know, pretending we have the answers to everything. Well, it's never gone well for me as a parent, mm-hmm, because I don't have the answers to virtually anything. But when we sit down and say, I don't know how to stop that happening, or show me exactly what popped up and where it came from, and then we'll see, can we figure it out or whatever. It's about sitting down, saying, I don't know, often as a first line, because it's the honest answer much of the time. And then sitting with the child as you move towards a solution, because you'll figure it out pretty quick, to be honest, if you've some basic familiarity with the app and you sit with the child and they point to the problem or point to what happened, you will figure it out. But the key is not to pretend you know straight off. Sit down, say, I don't know, show me what the problem is, and walk through it together.
Mm. And so, Alex, one of the most common phrases that comes into the Tech Talk email and has done for the last 6 or 7 years is, I'm a parent, I feel powerless because I'm not across all of this. I don't understand how to screenshot something on TikTok or how to report something on Snapchat. Is there such a thing as a cheat sheet for parents to try and know, if this happens, then I do that, regardless of the platform?
Yeah, I wish there were, like, just one simple cheat sheet. I think it will get a bit better on that front, because we now have Commissioner Mann in place, and one of their roles is to raise awareness and provide information about what's changing in these digital environments and what's new in terms of children's rights in these digital environments. And, you know, better signposting. So one of the things that they're asking for through this new online safety code, which you may be aware kind of came into play this year or kind of fully into force this year. But, you know, there needs to be much better signposting to things like reporting, mm-hmm, parental controls, resources that are available. So this is an expectation that we should have, that these apps that kids are using have much better mechanisms in place and signposts in place. if you want really good objective advice, you know, there are some great sources that you can go to. So we would often say, if your child is coming home to you and asking about a particular Apple game, like a, you know, a Snapchat or a Roblox, go to Common Sense Media, have a look at what they say. They give very balanced information. What I like about the way they present information is that they give their own expert view, but they will often give a parent view and a child view, which is always entertaining. Children tend to push the age limit, down, so they think it's sort of suitable from about five up, whereas the parents and the experts will give us, like, but you know, you're getting that sort of balanced sense of what is this app and is my child ready for it, and what are the things that I can do if I am going to let them use that app or game that I can do to make it a bit safer or to check in. So I think that's a great resource. WebWise is a great resource, which I'm sure many people are familiar with. They have a program through schools, but they would have a lot of parental advice. Our website, cybersafekids.ie, we have a gadget gift guide, which looks at devices and has you know, some advice around how you can set up things like parental controls and some of the considerations with that. And this year, we'll have an alternatives to section, because increasingly we're seeing coming on the market, you know, if you're not ready to give your child a kind of fully functioning smartphone with all the access, then there are these more kind of limited versions which have some access. So you have the likes of Spotify and WhatsApp and Google Maps. So it's called mindful use, rather than, so you're picking up the phone for a specific purpose as opposed to just picking it up to scroll endlessly. Mm-hmm. So that might be something that suits you, or an Explorer watch or something like that, which doesn't have the connectivity to the internet, but has location tracking and has, you know, connectivity. You can call them. So there are more alternatives there as well. So yeah, between Commissioner Mann, WebWise, Common Sense Media, you will get a good sense of the, you know, good apps, good parental controls, good advice.
What to look out for, essentially.
What to look out for, yeah.
You mentioned Commissioner Mann there, and I think it's a good time for us to talk a little bit about the Online Safety Commissioner, the Online Safety Code, what's in it, what's not in it, and how people in this room or people listening to this can engage. So Dara, you might just set the scene a little bit in terms of this. What is it? How did it come about? And what is the overarching idea behind it?
Sure. Because I was going to make the point that as a parent, you must be feeling, gosh, there's a load of things I need to now be doing to action some of the points that we've been sharing. And young people and parents quite rightly say, why is it on us when we have big tech giants and forces beyond our control that are causing a lot of the issues here? Cue the regulator. So coming from the Digital Services Act at a European Union level, Ireland's Commissioner Mann has established its own online safety code to set out how they are going to do that, such that we can legally mandate a platform to be able to respond to online harms and show that they are preventing them. It's an ambitious framework. They've specified the specific video sharing platforms that are at play here. Some of the kind of areas that need to still be addressed are that at the time of its drawing up was not included, so Gen AI might not fit some of the current kind of frameworks that we currently have. So that's
artificial intelligence. That's the generative artificial intelligence that you're seeing popping up everywhere, and adults are using and abusing it, and politicians are using and doing it in a great crack kind of way, but it's normalizing artificial intelligence content, which is scary. But that is, as you said, not included in the code.
And often in the form of chatbots, which are increasingly being embedded in apps that children are using.
Mm. So that's probably a very quick summary of it, but it's good to know what legally it's. So in terms of actions where something bad happens and you think, what can I specifically do? You can use the resources on Commissioner Mann to specifically see where this might fall within the online safety code. Can you report, and what's the obligation of that platform to respond to you? So that can be empowering to know where that specifically, where a certain kind of online harm specifically sits. So I'd encourage people to check those resources. They are launching a child-friendly version of some of these very technical kind of documents, as well as a plain English summary, which I think we'll all benefit from. Mm. It's a 60-page document, so a lot is happening, and it was only as recent as July. So it'll be interesting to see, the devil's in the detail, how will this be actually implemented? So I'd encourage people to check those resources as well.
And they're introducing a program into primary schools at fifth and sixth class level, a digital literacy program. Now, it probably opt in, so schools will have to choose to engage with it. But again, that's something you as parents can encourage the schools. If you know that this resource is available, it's a really good fifth and sixth class, is a really good time just before they're going into secondary school. Mm. Probably going to get a bit more access, you know, maybe even getting that smartphone for the first time, just to have that preparation in schools.
But, and again, I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, right? The online safety code is a great stepping stone towards meaningful progress. But the video platforms, they've come up with this term VLOPs, which is horrific to say, but the very large online platforms, they are, there's only a few of them listed. There's also a whole cohort of the internet that's not listed and not covered. And so we do have areas that are still not covered.
Yeah. So with the online safety code, it's looking specifically at 10 entities that are based in Ireland. So some of them you'll be very familiar with, TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, those sorts of platforms. It doesn't include Snapchat because Snapchat's not based in the state, but there is overlap. So we have this umbrella legislation as well, and not to, but European level legislation, the Digital Services Act. And we in Ireland have a special responsibility because we host so many of the companies here in Ireland. So we're not only kind of putting in place our online safety code, but we're also making sure that we're implementing the Digital Services Act and the kind of child protection guidelines related to that. So we have quite an added weight of responsibility, and that 15 of the 25 VLOPs, or VLOS as they're called, which is very large online platform or very large online search engine, 15 of them are based here in Ireland. So we have an extra responsibility to oversee theirs. And there's a lot of crossover. So some of the requirements, for example, around age. So up to this point, it's been very easy for an underage child to access pretty much any app, even if it has a minimum age requirement of 13, 16 or 18. And this has been obviously hugely problematic when you think of some of the content that might be available in on those places. And this is something we in CyberSafe Kids have been tracking. So we've been looking at underage uses. We've been quantifying it every year. And it's really useful because you can go into these companies and say, but we know that there are underage children, so what are you doing about it? Now we have laws that say self-declaration of age is no longer acceptable. Mm. So you can't, you know, a kid can't just go in, a 10-year-old, and say, I'm 18 or I'm 16, and get access. In theory, they shouldn't be able to do that. But obviously, the reality is these things take time. So today, they can still do that. Even 18-plus apps, I'm afraid, they can still just declare themselves to be over 18 and access anyway. But we will be monitoring. All of us, I would imagine, over this next year will be closely looking at what is changing, particularly around that 18-plus content, which would be, you know, extreme violence, pornography, really the stuff we don't want our kids to see. That should happen quicker. We should see age gates. It's a little vague, I think, in terms of, you know, whether it's age verification, which is black and white, this person is of age, or age assurance, which is kind of, you know, more maybe like using facial recognition, for example, to get an estimate. But we should see these changes coming into play. We will be monitoring it. We'll be reporting on it. Mm. But this will help parents if there are more sort of stringent requirements. You know, children, I've heard so many parents say, well, I didn't know they were on Snapchat, but they just, you know, downloaded it and were on it, or I didn't know they had a YouTube account and now they're posting all this stuff. So we wanted, obviously, we do think it's so important that parents and kids are kind of together. So if they're on YouTube, you know about it, you're alongside them, because it's all preparation for that greater degree of independence they're going to get as they age.
And we have seen some progress, you know, in the last few weeks. Meta launched the teen accounts, not only on Instagram, but also on the other platforms as well. We know that TikTok has done some work in terms of trying to ring fence content that's inappropriate for the younger users on those apps. But my question is always, is that it? Is there not more they can do? Because I am sure that if, and this is hypothetical, but if somebody who owned one of these platforms was so inclined and they didn't want me to see certain content, they could make that happen overnight. And this kind of was reinforced in my brain, was it last year, when Mark Zuckerberg said, we're going to start allowing news content back on Meta platforms. So somewhere they had turned that content off because they realized that people weren't into it, they weren't sharing it, whatever. But they made a decision to allow that content back on. That means that they have these powers at their little fingertips to tweak what we see. The teen accounts, the press briefings that I was at in relation to this, again, show that they can turn off access to content relating to eating disorders, suicide, self-harm, a whole host of other things for a certain age group. So again, there are powers and controls. So Dara, I'm just wondering, do we need to carry all of this burden, or do we need to shout louder for the tech companies to stand up and take a bit more on their plate?
It's always the same answer, isn't it? Multi-stakeholder collaboration is the solution. We always need to, all of us need to be at the table talking to that question. It's a perfect question to ask. If the big tech companies wanted to prioritize child safety the same way they did digital marketing, we wouldn't have this problem. That much we know. Where the regulator is trying to flex some muscle, as we've discussed, we've advanced somewhat. We have that kind of, what was the phrase today that we heard, this kind of benchmark for compliance. We now have some legal powers to actually hold up the mirror to certain companies and say, if you're not doing this, then, you know, potentially you can kick them out of the market. The big politics at play will continually evolve, and parents and young people will also feel somewhat disempowered or empowered depending on how we respond. So your exact summary there as to the turning on and off of content is a perfect example of what a child might do in a digital literacy program. Did you know that there's a reason why you might be seeing this feed of information? And did you know that, for example, you can reset your algorithm on TikTok? I didn't know this until I did the tour of the Transparency Center. That can be quite empowering. I keep getting this influencer that keeps talking about this fitness stuff or this body image stuff. Let's reset that. That can be something that can be quite refreshing. And there's many, many steps, but they're completely different across apps. So kind of going back to Brendan's point, having that holistic conversation obliquely, show me what's going on when you scroll TikTok. And actually, when that happens, a lot of parents get into TikTok themselves.
Yeah.
But share the experience. What do you hate about TikTok? What do you love about Instagram? Mm. Walk through that and then look at, okay, if something goes bad, what does that look like? What does that feel like? What's the one thing that would make it a little bit better? And that's where we begin to identify actionable steps whilst the regulators and big politics do their thing. So I think that's where we kind of go from the macro to the micro.
Yeah, I'd also highly recommend everyone in this room, if you're on any social platform, go in and reset your algorithm. I did it recently and it is so good for the soul, because it stops you seeing stuff that annoys you. It clears up your explore page. It's just a good thing to do. But Brendan, I wanted to pick up on that point, because we know, because CyberSafe and others have done great research, and they have shown that people who aren't age appropriate are on platforms. And I wanted to focus a little bit on the impact of an 11-year-old being on a platform that they shouldn't be on until they're 13, 14, 15, 16. Because I remember, and I'm still like this now, but I get overwhelmed and I get anxious and I'm a people pleaser. I want to keep everyone happy all the time. I want to watch everyone's video. If they've gone to the effort of making a video, I want to watch it, I want to like it, and I want to be their friend. And I'm like that at 36. So I can imagine someone who's 9, 10, 11, 12, getting that sense of overwhelm, maybe developing either parasocial friendships and relationships with these people, being influenced to look and act and speak a certain way, because their brains are still evolving, right?
Yes, yes. Now, at the age of 36, your brain is all done.
Oh, what's God, I'm a hopeless case.
Oh, no. What you got is what you got.
So. Oh, dear.
But great. Yeah, like the brain is substantially developing until the mid-20s.
Mm.
So, you know, we're all at stages of immaturity prior to that. And look, there's no easy way to say this, but boys are boys are about a year behind for a lot of that time in terms of overall brain maturation, which is why there are these jaw-dropping differences in maturity between, say, adolescent boys and adolescent girls. Like, it's just ridiculous. But they're about a year behind. We are about a year behind at that stage. And all of this impacts hugely on our ability to negotiate complex social situations. And even when I say, in relation to teenage boys, about negotiating complex social situations, it's almost sounds like a joke. But it does happen. And it gets, if you like, hyped up on these platforms. And, you know, we don't want to stereotype young people, but generally among young girls, there is more of a search for community, and among the boys, more of a search for agency.
Mm.
Now, that is not absolute, but that is a definite trend, and you see it again and again. And this gets amplified, through their algorithms, through their clicking, and it gets magnified beyond anything that is copable with. So they get overwhelmed. We get overwhelmed with anxiety, for sure, with a feeling of not being good enough, and with social comparison, which we always do and always will do forever, but we do more of it and quicker.
Mm.
You know, it's done at an industrial scale very quickly on some of the platforms. So yeah, so this tends to reduce feelings of control and feelings of esteem as well, among both boys and girls who struggle to cope with it, for sure.
I want to talk about the boys, because I did an unscientific experiment whereby I set up different platforms purporting to be a 12-year-old boy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did the same thing purporting to be a 14-year-old boy, giving basic information on the platforms that would let me on for those ages. And within a matter of scrolls, I was seeing content of what a man is and lads, and, you know, and it's just there. And I hadn't used the platforms enough for them to recommend content based on my behavior. It was the assumption, because you're male and you're those ages, this is what you should and would like to be seeing. And that scared me, because it was highly engaging. And you could see, if you think about the young men in your life, how engaging and intoxicating it could be. So what can we, as parents and aunts and uncles and, you know, loved ones of young boys in particular, do to not only engage them in conversation about this, but also help them see the wood for the trees?
Yeah, so look, I mean, the first thing is not to demonize the technology completely, because that's like trying to hold the ocean back with your bare hands. Exploring it with people is important, and emphasizing, I suppose I've heard it called digital empathy, that the people you see are performing a lot of the time, but they are nonetheless people. And that is a very important kind of conjoint point, particularly if people start accessing pornography at a certain age.
Mm.
So I guess that's the first thing. The other thing to note is the general degradation, and I don't know, am I allowed to use the word enshittification? Is that a word I'm allowed to use?
You can use it, because it's scientific.
It has become so crass that certainly some of the more recent studies about screen time show adolescents reducing their screen time compared to 2 and 3 years ago. There's been a series of studies, including one from the London School of Economics, showing a reduction, or if you like, a growing awareness that what people are seeing on these automated algorithmic scrolls are not necessarily as real as was previously thought. There does seem to be a small stepping back, particularly from the very high users, seems to be coming down. So there is something of an awareness, Jess, that this isn't the real world, that this is generated content, as it were. But I think the key thing is always keeping the communication open with the child, sitting with them, looking at stuff, and just being there and teaching them this critical faculty, which they're going to need in an era of AI anyway.
I know that Adolescence on Netflix scared a lot of people. It was an eye-opener for a lot of people, and it was a talking point around a lot of kitchen tables, around a lot of water coolers in offices. And Dara, I'm just wondering, this was a TV show. It was brilliantly written, brilliantly acted, the one-shot thing, incredible. Mm-hmm. But it was a very highlighted example of what goes on, and parents were terrified about this secret code of apps and emojis that kids are now using. Just talk us through the response to that, and how true to life is it? Is it sensationalised just for the telly?
A bit of both. Fascinating example of something that was perhaps bubbling on under the surface culturally for all age groups. A couple of observations first off. If a quick show of hands, who's seen adolescents? Okay.
Almost everyone.
Sobering.
Yeah.
The four boys in that school, the detective's own son, who was unharmed, unbothered by the extremist kind of manosphere incel content, who actually pointed out to the detective that, "Dad, you need to look at this. This could be involved in the case against Jamie." Jamie himself, who from a seemingly happy family, radicalized by this online content. And then there's two other characters that are involved as maybe more kind of co-conspirators, but don't go on to commit a crime. It does reflect a reality that it's not a dose-dependent response with certain content. In many ways, the extremist, misogynistic subcultures online, they are in part a reflection of the politics of division that we see in the world. Your Trumpian politics and McGregor's of the world versus the other end of the spectrum. But the online world intensifies it all the more and turns it into a clickbait and kind of soundbite things that are very appealing sometimes to adolescents, particularly in the area of masculinity, where there's an argument that, you know, conversation about what does masculinity mean to you isn't really had. And there's an argument that influencers are actually exploiting that to give their version of a more toxic, problematic, traditionalist kind of version of masculinity and all that goes with it. What does all this mean in terms of what you can do if you're concerned about it? I'd flag a openly accessible guide that we published in the Anti-Bullying Centre addressing the impact of masculinity influencers. We can link it later on. And we just go through some kind of evidence-based tips as to how you might broach that conversation in the first place if you're concerned about boys in your life that might be looking at this stuff. And one of the top tips is meeting them where they are at rather than where we would like them to be at. A lot of the response to adolescents was, "Oh my God, we need to have a policy response to this. We need to make this mandatory viewing in schools to show to boys this is what you could become if you could." It's a fear. It's fear that is prompting that knee-jerk reaction. Whereas the only time boys might have ever been asked, "What does masculinity mean to you?" is when parents are having a knee-jerk response motivated by fear. So we need to kind of be mindful of not jumping to things that we think might help, whereas actually there's a much broader set of problems there. And to one final example, one kind of very specific talking point that works quite well, possibly with older cohorts, but increasingly younger cohorts, the whole issue of strength. Right, so what does it mean to be a man? You have to be strong and tough, and that's a narrative that is abused by the likes of Andrew Tate and many other influencers, and it's a soundbite. And with that you get the Instagram lifestyle of physique heavy kind of visuals. You take the most boring public health angle to strength. You go to the HSE guidelines now. They would mostly recommend resistance training is important for most adults, and for some cohorts, it's a very important part of life. But we don't see that coming out through the influencers. It's a very particular interpretation of a very boring piece of science to do with resistance training, and it's converted into something else. You can debunk these things for young people and show them how this is a particular version of strength and masculinity that is being thrown at you. It's often not by choice for very particular reasons. So you kind of pre-bunk or you debunk what's being thrown at them to give them the tools to call out BS when they see it the next time.
Did you want to come in on that?
Well, I was only that just what we're seeing for boys is that sort of content, and then for girls there's a lot more around body image mm-hmm. and kind of self-esteem and you know, this focus on what you eat. So there is no question that the way the recommender algorithm works is that it is sending the user content based on their gender, their age, sometimes their location, sometimes their religion. It is detailed information. So, you know, one level, I do think we need to be challenging that model and, you know, saying, is that acceptable for all of us to be served this content, sent down these rabbit holes? That is something that is addressed through the Digital Services Act, the one I was mentioning earlier. But whether it's going to go far enough to really challenge, you know, that's, you know, Instagram Teens is a really good example where they have marketed it as the safe, you know, this is their response to this new regulation. We now have a safe recommender algorithm for teens. And, you know, I think it's very difficult to have a safe algorithm if its primary focus is still engagement, which it is. So mm-hmm. I think you'll still find that inappropriate content is coming through. So I think we need to really look at the whole model. But I think that, as you said, as you've both said, the conversations, if you're having a knee-jerk conversation on the back of something like adolescence, you're not going to debunk, you know, something that has been, you know, going into their brains for a really long period of time. These ongoing conversations about what they might encounter online, what they might see, you know, really getting them to think about challenging the content they're encountering. We need to be doing this in school through critical literacy, digital literacy programs. We need to be doing it at home through our conversations with kids about stuff we're seeing as well. And you know, like talking about fake news, talking about mis and disinformation. This is unfortunately a normal part of our world. It always has been, but it's so much more amplified online. And it's obviously very believable in a lot of cases. So having these conversations in an ongoing way and sharing our experiences as well, I think is important, rather than that kind of panicked knee-jerk response to something like adolescence, which was very gripping, but yeah.
It was great TV. And I think it highlighted important conversations to have, but one point that sticks with me from that show in particular, and you saw it in Stephen Graham's character, was that the dad was so unaware. And Brendan, I'm not wishing this on anyone or anything like that, but what about the parents who go, oh, well, my child would never. They weren't brought up that way. Mm-hmm. And almost as a parent, you want to go into self-protection mode, because obviously you're implicated if your child is found to be a bully or using misogynistic or vile language in the playground or on the Gap pitch or whatever it is. How do you ensure that you're not going into cocoon mode rather than dealing with something head on?
Yeah, I mean, it's about being there from the word go, not just during the crisis or during the provocative TV show or whatever. So you're not just arriving in at that point or defending yourself at that point. And of course, anyone who says my child wouldn't do that, look, your child would. You know, it's someone's child who is the school bully. It's someone's child who is doing these things for sure. And I think most parents have some level of awareness of that. I mean, what did strike me in adolescence as well was the father's feelings of helplessness in the whole situation. Mm. I mean, the fact is that centered on a child murder, which is something that's vanishingly rare.
Yeah.
And it was fiction. I think that got very much lost in the discussion. This was sort of the worst, most catastrophic outcome that anyone could imagine, and yet it was almost taken as this is how most children are. Mm. I think that point didn't come out as clearly as I would have liked at the time during this avalanche of reaction to a show that was fiction and that concerned a very, very rare outcome indeed, that in fact has never been rarer in the world than it currently is. And in these discussions, one of the huge factors is our human desire to catastrophize and to presume everything is terrible and getting worse and about to get a lot worse a lot quicker. And we see this very much in relation to technology and phones. Mm. Whereas if we step back from those technologies for a moment and say that during the past couple of decades, many things in the world have improved very, very, very substantially. And just to say a few of the things here. Over the past 20 years, we know, for example, that the rate of suicide in the world and in Ireland has fallen very dramatically. So in the past 12 years, it's fallen by 25% in Ireland. Mm. And in the past 10 years, self-harm has fallen by 10% as well. So we're seeing some really, really big improvements in mental health. And this is also in young people, by the way. And these are very steady changes that we're seeing. We're seeing crime falling as well over the past 10 years, and particularly the past 3 years. So we're seeing a lot of really good things happen at the same time as these technologies are being introduced into the world. Now, I'm not drawing a causal link. I'm just simply saying the ship is not sinking uncontrollably. Mm. And certainly the outcome that we saw in adolescence has never been rarer in the world and in our countries than it is today. So we just got to be aware, I think, in these discussions of our desire, our human desire to panic and our ability to catastrophize. It's just something we do. And as you intimated earlier, we do it particularly about the new technologies, about TV, about video games, about the radio, about steam power. We catastrophized all of them along the lines of that they placed too much stress on people. People couldn't cope and would become mentally ill.
Alex, yeah.
Can I just pick on something you said earlier about, which I think is highlighted in the programme, about the use of devices in bedrooms and particularly overnight? Because I think that, to me, was quite striking. I don't know if others picked up on that, but he was using his device in the bedroom overnight. And I think you are completely excluded as parent or carer from what your kids are accessing online, you know, what they're seeing, what they're doing, how long they're spending, who they're talking to. So I think if there was one key takeaway apart from the conversations, it would be to keep devices out of bedrooms overnight and to do it yourselves too. It really, in order to have kind of that good modelling that you were talking about. But yeah, it's...
Yeah, it's, and again, that's something that's practical. You can do it, you can start it tonight, and you will get the benefits of it. I do want to say, though, just so I don't lose my job, I'm a tech fan. Like, this isn't anti-technology, right? And it's not about saying never let your kids engage with technology at all. It's about going into it eyes wide open and having these conversations. And there are brilliant examples of young people engaging with technology and finding their tribe through it, whether it's in coding club or whether it is, you know, editing. Like, my nephew is 9 and he can edit better than I can, and I've been working in radio for 17 years. Like, there are so many good sides to it. I do think trying to encourage where you can, but also being on standby and being there and having them prepped for having someone to turn to if and when something does go awry is vitally important. I can't believe we're coming up towards the end. We do have some questions here. I'm going to open it to the floor in the next minute or two. So if you do have a question, throw your paw in the air and we'll get a mic to you. But before we do that, there is one question here that says, I have a Samsung Smart TV. How can I limit my 8-year-old's access to watching YouTube on it without hiding the remote control? So the good news is that you can absolutely hide the remote, but you can go into the settings. So if you go to the home screen on your Samsung TV, it'll bring you to the Smart Hub, navigate to the apps, go to your settings. You'll see the little gear icon there. If you select the YouTube app, you can lock the app, so you can put a pin in place. If you click on that and you can put a pin in place, don't have it as your date of birth or your child's date of birth. Don't have it as 000. They will try all of the things, but that's a very simple, easy, quick and free solution to that. Another question, Alex, is in relation to roadblocks. So the question is, can you tell me how safe Roblox is for my 7-year-old? He doesn't have it, but his friend has it. Is it safe?
So Roblox is marketed to children as young as 5. And it certainly has a very childlike appearance in terms of the avatar. So it is very appealing to young people. It is the number one most popular app in Ireland with children under the age of 13. This has been steadily growing. So it is really increasing in popularity. It is a universe. So it's not like one game that you're playing. You're really looking at a whole wealth of games and content, user-generated content. Is it safe? No, you can encounter harm on Roblox, absolutely. Does it have good parental controls? Yeah, and actually you can avoid quite a number of those harms by using those parental controls. Are they completely fail-safe? No. So what we would say is, if your child is seven, in the case of this example, is have them where you can see them. So keep them in the living room, kitchen, or whatever, where you can check in more easily, play with them. Co-use is often a really good way of getting to know an app as well, or getting to know a game, or getting to know that universe in this case. So there are suitable games, there are unsuitable games. They do have different age ratings for different types of content on Roblox. So they have even 17 plus content. Sometimes things get through, like we've spoken to children who have had negative experiences in Roblox or in different games in Roblox. So it is not one that you can kind of just leave them to it and walk away. We would say, you know, be there alongside them, or at least able to check in with them. So keep them where you can see them, basically.
Mm. Okay, are there any questions in the room before we do more? Okay, so if we can get the mic over.
Thank you so much. And I really enjoyed the talk. And like before I came, I was reading the book, Anxious Generation. And then after I listened to Brandon just mentioned, in Ireland in the last few years, the self-harming rate has decreased. And then the suicide rate has decreased. And the criminal rate has decreased. Actually balance how I feel. So thank you so much. It's really, really provide us balanced view. So I love the talk. I have a quick question here is, like at home, myself and my husband, we're both an Apple user. We have our own iPhone, we have our iPad. But for the children, like my son just started secondary school, and then the school as everyone gets the Chromebook. Mm-hmm. And then for us, we thought, okay, great. Probably there's already some control in it. I only just found out last week it wasn't any controls. We like to put some parental control. I just wonder, is that possible as Apple user, we can put some parental control for the Android devices and the Chromebooks, please?
Yeah, so it can be done. And this is where the Google Family Link portal comes into play. So what you can do, even though you have an iPhone, you can set up a Gmail account if you don't have one already. And then your child, if they're using the Chromebook, will already have a Gmail address as well. So you essentially need to get those two email addresses to talk to each other by going into the Google Family Link, and you will have controls in place. Now, I'd just double check that the school, because sometimes they would have some form of protection in the background,
yeah,
in terms of firewalls,
they've
nothing. Yeah. Okay, well, it might be worth asking that question of the school, because if their school issued devices, like this laptop in front of me is a Newstalk issued device, I have security software on this. If I try to go onto certain websites, not that I've tested it, but I have. But if I try to go onto certain websites, I can't, because it's blocked from an admin point of view. So I think, although we can solve it for your child, I think saying it to the school and requesting that their software put in place.
I have already did, but unfortunately they were saying like the kids in school, they're not able to access anything else. Mm. But children this age, they're so smart. I've heard my son came back, said his XYZ in the senior year, they put in some VPN in there. They all have that, and they get through the wall. So exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
No worries. So do set up the Google Family Link for yourself anyway, and have it tied, your child's account tied to your account, and hopefully
that
will do the job.
I've had to do that as well.
Could I make a quick comment on the Anxious Generation book? Because I've heard a lot of parents mention it, and I'll just call out my own bias. I mostly reject the claims in that book, and I'm worrying that it's doing more harm than good, just for the fear factor of what parents are saying. So I just flagged that there's a whole range of boring academics that actually completely dispute the claims from Jonathan Haidt.
Shots
and I'm one
fired.
Of them. And maybe Brendan and I are going to have a fallout at the break.
Boring academics.
Boring. Who'd have thought it?
Who'd have thought it? I know, in fairness, the book, Anxious Generation, it is largely rooted in the US experience. And the statistics I gave you about suicide declining in the world by a third over the past couple of decades, the US has gone in the opposite direction. When I said earlier, screen time is falling among adolescents, in 50 countries surveyed around the world, one country is going against that trend, and it's the US. So I think it's important to look at country-specific statistics, and what I was talking about is here. And certainly, you know, I mean, that is not to say these problems are solved. Even one person dying by suicide is one too many. And that is a crisis, as long as there's even one, just to be absolutely clear. But just to say, positive change is happening.
Yeah.
And it coincides with all of the other developments in the world over the past couple of decades.
But also the fact that we have EU legislation and regulations, like we are addressing this issue, and it's something that very often tech companies in the US criticize Europe for. They say that we're stifling innovation because we have things like GDPR, the Digital Services Act, the EU AI Act. It's actually a good thing for us that we are addressing some of these issues from that level, and then all of the other supplementary things as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're getting a lot more top down here from companies and regulation, as well as the bottom up that is happening. And there's always going to be a mix.
Yeah.
I think, like most of us, I think there could be a lot more coming from the top. But ultimately, these are companies.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a different end goal in mind.
Thanks a million. So it was brilliant conversation so far. I had two sort of practical questions. One I found interesting where you said you can reset the algo, which I didn't know about.
Mm.
So I'm interested on practically how to do that.
Yep.
Can it be done on all the apps? And also then, is there an option to opt out of certain content in the algorithm or not?
So there are a few different things there. So when it comes to resetting your algorithm on TikTok and on Instagram, when you go to your profile, so you tap your little picture, then you go to the settings and privacy, and then you can scroll down to, I think it's just content reset, content preferences, and then refresh your feed. What you're looking for is your profile, settings and privacy, content preferences, and then refresh your feed. And what that does is it removes all of those assumptions based on what you've watched and engaged with before. It gets rid of all that, so you're kind of back to day one. What I would note, though, is the second you watch a video or engage with content, it's starting to build that picture up again, and that's why it's good to go back and reset it a few times. In terms of preventing stuff from appearing, I've done this week with the Taylor Swift album because I'm blue in the face seeing Taylor Swift all over my algorithms. So what I've done is going into that exact same portal, the content preferences, and you can block certain hashtags and certain tags from appearing. So I've done TS, Ophelia, all of the Opalites, all of that stuff. I've put all of those phrases in. I clearly have nothing else to do with my life. I have nothing else going on. But I went in, did that, blocked all of that content. So you can do it. If you're noticing certain content appearing on your child's feed and it's being tagged in a certain way, you can block that. Again, to note, the head of Instagram mentioned recently enough, they're actually doing away with the hashtags as being a key indicator of content on the platform. So the way content is displayed might change again, which is frustrating, and we'll watch it. But there are two practical things, again, that you can do. So you can refresh the feed and then block hashtags.
And we should, in theory, be getting more tools available to children to reset preferences or to say, I don't like this content, you know, don't show it to me. This is what this new regulation is, you know, is trying to encourage, but it is encouraging as opposed to mandating them.
A quick one on that as well. You could, if it's TikTok, if the child is worried about losing all of the cool accounts that they love, just make sure they follow them. Mm-hmm. So it could be a nice conversation starter. Okay, how about we reset the algorithm, but we keep the stuff that you love. So you might sit down and say, what stuff do you love? And you can follow those accounts. The worst thing about TikTok is when you go onto it, you're often straight on the For You page rather than the following page. So it could be a slight little digital habit change there. There's, 20 to 30 people that they'd love to follow actively, so this will get that kind of exploratory hit, you know. So if they can isolate those followers and then reset as well. So there's a couple of ways in there to...
Sorry, I had one other question, actually.
Yeah,
The other one was just in relation to, and this is probably Big Brother stuff, but the parental control apps. Is there an app that exists that gives you, you know, the way, say, in work you get your IT department can access your desktop remotely? Is there something like that exists that you can see the kids' phone, their screen remotely?
There is, I know one in the US that has a Bark, which would give you, like, so you can have kind of levels of intervention, so there'd be kind of light touch, but I'm not aware of one.
There's a few that are floating around and you see them every now and then. And again, in terms of the use of them and also in terms of, I suppose it's the ethics and the morals of it. You know, I've received press releases from individuals who say they've created apps for this purpose. And I tend to steer clear for them because I personally don't like the notion of going down that road. I'd be interested, like, what's your view, Brendan, in terms of how do we balance the seesaw of privacy for the child, but also parenting and looking out for them?
Sure. I mean, it's the same balance we have to reach when they start riding a bicycle and eventually you let go of the back of it and off they go. They're within, you know, in your eye line for a while, but then they're around the corner and they're on their own. So it's about, you know, reaching, you know, realizing this is similar.
Mm.
This is basically the same process. It feels scarier, but it's actually quite similar. So I guess there's no absolute answer to that question about when you let go of the back of the bike, whenever you feel they're pedaling on their own. That metaphor is really straining now. Can you intervene, please?
I'll just take it away from you.
Thanks.
Back in the room. But it goes back to what we said at the very beginning, right, of setting sort of core principles in the house. So if it's dinner time, phones are off the table or they're turned down. Or someone from the RSPCC said to me a few years ago on a Friday, swap phones, you know, put your phone in and so you take my phone and you see Eric has just texted you. Who's Eric? Oh, he's my boss. You know, those kind of little, give your kid access, you take access, have conversations about what they're, who you're talking to, what apps you're using, and normalize it so that then you don't need to have that level of big brother minute by minute, second by second, because I don't think that's healthy for anyone.
Well, I think if you can get to the stage where they're challenging you as well, like I find my kids now, like I'll say something, maybe I heard it on the news, and they'll be like, where'd you hear it? Have you fact checked it? How many sources?
I love that.
How, you know, how legitimate, you know? And if they think that I get so ribbed on my behavior now. And if I'm on the phone or if I'm double screening, because I'm often like, oh, that actor, I'm going to look them up.
Mm.
So I feel like my kids are way more on me now. So it's kind of the tables have turned. But I see it all as a good thing because it's all about talking about it. And there are times where I have to say, no, you're right. I'm not listening. I'm not listening to what you're saying. Please say it again. Because we do get so distracted ourselves. And a lot of us struggle with our own use of these devices. So how we're supposed to kind of then give these good messages. But as you said, device-free times, device-free zones, you know, these are all kind of helpful things, healthy habits in the household that we can foster. We have, just to give it a plug, our cyber break coming up next Friday, which is a 24-hour break from devices. You sign up. And what we say is we're not too hard either. So if we say, if you can't do the 24 hours, just try the Friday evening.
Mm-hmm.
To see, could you all leave your devices? And even if it's watching a movie together or going for a walk or whatever, having pizza, it's more about the kind of trying to set, reset, have that healthy balance, have that togetherness away from your devices and seeing if you can. And it might become something you do more regularly. But anyway, cyberbreak.ie if you
always
want
hustling,
to sign
Alex.
Up.
Always hustling.
I know.
But no, it is a great initiative. And I started doing it as a New Year's resolution a few years ago when I was going out of my mind with anxiety. I started doing a phone-free hour. So I started and desperately tried to just put my phone in airplane mode for an hour a day. And I thought I was the best girline in all the land. I managed 10 minutes. I just was like, what if someone's trying to call me? But I still do it now. I persevered and I do it now. And for that 1 hour, sometimes I do longer, but it goes airplane mode in a drawer and I just waddle around the house and do my bits. But I feel the benefit of it again as an adult. And so leading by example really does seem to make a difference based on what all of you have said here now. Unfortunately, we are up against the clock. I want to make this kind of like an Oprah Winfrey inspirational moment, okay? So what is your one key takeaway for everybody to make them feel empowered and give them something practical to go home with?
Okay. Oh, right. When I said don't put me on the spot at the end, what do you think I meant?
Did I say yes? No, I didn't.
Look, technology is powerful and good and bad, like everything that is powerful. And if we run away from it, we'll be scared forever, and so will our children. So it is all about engagement with it and with them and looking at it together. And, you know, that means pretending you need their help with certain things. We often do. And that gets the conversation flowing in both directions about the technology.
Great stuff. Thank you very much. Dara, what's your...
That's what I was going to say. it's okay to feel overwhelmed. You being here is actually extremely telling, and it's a very good sign. Double down on all the other things that aren't tech. School, friends and family, physical activity, sleep. Getting those right... Mm-hmm. Only so many hours in the day, and actioning some of the top tips that you heard here today, you've gone light years ahead of so many others.
Alex?
Well, I was going to say both. I think maybe even making a commitment yourself tonight. Okay, one thing I'm going to do when I, you know, I'm going to look up that app, or I'm going to start that conversation, or we're going to have that cyber break or whatever, you know, but just try and have a commitment and follow through in it, because it really does make a difference. And as Dara said, you being here, like that's you know, a really important step in this journey, finding out more information, empowering yourself with information, and then going home and engaging. There is no perfect way to do this, but engaging and having those conversations is really vital.
I was going to say all of that, and I have nothing left to say except thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate it. Just keep the conversations going. You can always reach out to us, to CyberSafe Kids. If you've got any questions, if you're looking for guidance, there are plenty of resources out there. So please just feel free to use them. But a huge thank you to Alex, Dara and Brendan for joining us. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
man. And thanks to you.
Hey football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.